In 2010, the largest oil spill in American history captivated the public's attention. Authorities told a story of a response effort that prevented a worst-case scenario. But if you ask some people who lived through the spill, they'll tell you a more complicated story.
They weren't attending to the workers.
I was bleeding from everywhere.
We were all lied to.
From Western Sound and APM Studios comes a new investigative podcast, Ripple, available now.
In China, the population is shrinking, and it's expected to keep shrinking.
And it's going to have very long-lasting implications for China's future.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Also today, we speak with a British doctor who volunteered at a hospital in the Gaza Strip, treating people injured in war.
When I look into their eyes, I feel I've got no choice but to go out and help them.
Plus, new data show the ice sheets that blanket Greenland are melting faster than anyone realized.
And in Uganda, we meet the women who have the knowledge for a specific group of tourists, birdwatchers.
Even when someone is not all that interested in a bird, but by the time you finish talking to this person will have got that love for birds.
That and a possible political shakeup in Spain.
All coming up today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being with us today. For the second year in a row, China's population has declined, this time by more than 2 million people. It's a big deal for China because it needs working-age people to power its economy.
Many young people there, and critically young Chinese women, do not want to have kids. They're rejecting various incentives from the government to try to change their minds. Leighton Fischer is a scholar and the author of Leftover Women, The Resurgence of Gender Inequality in China. We reached her as she was traveling by train near New York. She says the news is not surprising.
The birth rate has been falling for about 7 consecutive years now. And also the marriage rate has been declining for 9 consecutive years. This is just the trajectory that China is on, and it's going to have very long-lasting implications for China's future and possibly even political problems for China's Communist Party.
Right. I mean, Beijing is obviously very concerned about this trend. I mentioned rejection of public incentives the Chinese government has offered in recent years to encourage people to choose to have babies. What kinds of things has the government tried?
Quite frankly, the incentives that the Chinese government is offering are just almost like window dressing. I mean, they're doing things like, for example, in one county, offering a cash reward of about 1,000 renminbi, which is just a little over $100 to newlywed couples if the bride is 25 years or younger. This is all part of Xi Jinping, who recently said that China needs to embrace a marriage and child-rearing culture. So just a few years ago, the Chinese government introduced a so-called three-child policy. So after more than 3 decades of its draconian one-child policy, now the government has done a complete turnaround and is trying to urge young women to marry and have not just one or two, but actually 3 children. And there's a lot of implicit threat behind that, actually. But what is really critical is that young women in China today, especially those who have gone to college and are somewhat better educated, are just not that interested in getting married or having babies anymore.
Can you talk a bit more about that overhanging, unspoken threat behind some of those incentives for people to have kids?
There's been this very insulting propaganda campaign that's been going on for a long time that insults single educated women and says that, you know, no man is ever going to want them if they don't get married as soon as possible. And the thing is that if these women don't marry and have children, employers are discriminating a lot more against the hiring of women. One thing that is quite ominous is that in recent years, the government has made it much more difficult, especially for women, to obtain a divorce, even when their spouse is proven to be very violent with them. But all of these problems mean that women who aren't married, who are also much more aware of widespread sexism in society, or maybe they're becoming more dissatisfied with the government that hasn't been delivering on its long promise of, you know, steadily increasing standards of living, along with slowing economic growth, that these women just increasingly don't want to marry or have babies at all.
Yeah, I mean, are Chinese women seeing this landscape and saying, right, even more reason not to have kids?
Yeah, absolutely. And then you have to factor in just the pandemic, because the government introduced an incredibly draconian zero COVID lockdown where millions of families were literally locked inside their homes. And so especially for young people, particularly young women, they're really unhappy about that. And so now the lockdown has been lifted. The last thing they want after emerging from a 3-year lockdown due to the pandemic is to rush into marriage and having babies. I mean, they want to try to enjoy their lives. They want to try to have careers and some sense of normalcy.
Are there any incentives that you think might persuade more younger Chinese people to have kids?
I mean, if the government really was determined to try to address young women's concerns about marriage and having babies, it would have to deliver enormous changes. It would have to do things like offer free childcare, free pre-K education, medical benefits, combat really entrenched gender discrimination in hiring, beef up its care of the elderly. But you're not seeing any of that at all.
On the economy, I mean, we hear about the declining economy argument. For the Chinese government, they want more babies to drive their economy. But we hear about the high cost of raising a child in China. How much is the waning economy a factor in women not wanting to raise children?
It's not just women. I mean, young people all across China are really concerned about the high cost of living, the high cost of housing and education. But that's been a long-standing problem, certainly well more than a decade. The thing is that really the government is just making things actually worse for women's rights. I think that it's going to be very, very hard for it to persuade young women to get married. What I worry about is the potential for increasing restrictions on reproductive rights. Already we're seeing that it's much more difficult to get a vasectomy in China. And I worry that they're going to be increasing restrictions on abortion. But the fact that so many young women today are really much more aware of the pitfalls of getting married and having babies, they're really standing up for their rights a lot more than they did, say, a decade ago. And this is one area, just trying to reclaim their private life, where young women still have control. I mean, they can decide if they want to marry or have a child.
Leyte Hong Fincher is the author of Leftover Women, The Resurgence of Gender Inequality in China, explaining the forces behind the continuing drop in China's population.
For almost 9 months now, Sudan has been ripped apart by fighting between rival military forces. On one side is the Sudanese army, and on the other, a paramilitary group called the Rapid Support Forces. The fighting has now driven more than 7 million people from their homes. It's killed more than 12,000 people and created one of the worst humanitarian emergencies in the world. Before this conflict erupted, Sudan had, after years of dictatorship, been hopeful about transitioning to a civilian-led democracy. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gakandi reports.
Shakir al-Hassan and his family had already been displaced by this war once. They were just starting to get used to their new life in Wad Madani when he heard the familiar sounds of airstrikes and shelling last month. He stepped out onto the streets and saw
thousands of people were in state of panic, fleeing, trying to reach the main road, taking them to Sinnar, the next town.
The Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, had moved into this area, pushing out the Sudanese army. Fearing for himself and his family's safety, Al-Hassan and his family fled a second time to Kassala in the east.
The town now is so, so crowded. People are sheltering in schools, in other buildings, people sheltering in open areas.
Al-Hassan isn't new to crisis. He works for CARE, one of the many NGOs working around the clock to provide humanitarian support to civilians. But Al-Hassan never imagined he would find himself fleeing one day.
But now it is very clear for me. What does it mean to leave your home, shelter in another place, strange for you, not sure what is going to happen tomorrow?
Multiple international efforts to end this conflict have failed. Earlier in January, RSF militia leader General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, or Hemeti, met with Sudan's former Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, who is leading a civilian-led peace effort. In a long speech, Hemeti claimed he was ready for peace and called on the army to come to the table. Hemeti has toured East Africa in a suit and tie instead of military fatigues. But on the ground, his forces continue to fight for more military gains. And with that comes accusations that his fighters are killing, looting, and raping civilians. On the opposite side, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan of the Sudanese Armed Forces has said RSF isn't sincere about wanting peace. Earlier this month, he said there would be no reconciliation with the RSF and encouraged civilians to arm themselves. Neither party is serious about ending the war, says Amgad Farid Al-Tayyib. He's the executive director of the FIKRA for Studies and Development, a Sudanese nonpartisan policy think tank.
This is a war between two morally compromised armies and two morally compromised factions who are fighting for illegitimate spoil of controlling the country.
El-Tayyib points out how both generals have worked together to undermine Sudan's democratic transition in recent years, including in a military coup in 2021. He argues the recent civilian-led peace effort is giving Hemeti political leverage and legitimacy as he seeks to present himself as Sudan's next leader. El-Tayyib says the international community needs to step up to end the fighting in Sudan.
What we are seeing right now is scandalous and it's shameful. That we have Sudan turning from a country that's going in a path of civilian and democratic transition to becoming the biggest humanitarian crisis in the world.
He argues at this point, Sudan needs direct international intervention to stop both parties from fighting. Shakil Al-Hassan of CARE says the humanitarian needs are growing every day.
Every day I see people arriving here in Kassala. Yesterday I was in the bus terminal. The tents prepared for receiving people is full and buses are coming with more people.
He worries the conflict might follow them. This fear keeps him up at night. Al-Hassan tells me he worries about the psychological impact this war is having on children.
I saw too many pictures, including from my daughter, with armed men with machine guns. I guess this is something that millions of Sudanese children have seen, and it will take too long to drop from their memory.
International and regional efforts to bring the two warring generals to the table remain ongoing. For the world, I'm Halima Kikandi, Nairobi.
Houthis are back on the terror list. That's an official designation the U.S. made today about the militant rebel group in Yemen, part of an effort to stop Houthis from attacking commercial ships in the Red Sea, a critical trade route for global commerce.
The Houthis have been striking cargo ships for weeks in a show of solidarity, they say, with Palestinians in Gaza. The terror designation comes with sanctions, an effort to cut off their financial support.
President Biden had taken the Houthis off the terror list in 2021 over concerns that sanctions cut off access to food and fuel for people in Yemen. Today, humanitarian organizations echoed that same concern that new sanctions on Houthis would ultimately hurt the Yemeni people. In addition to sanctions, the U.S. and the U.K. also began military strikes on Houthi positions last week.
Coming up, Greenland's ice is melting faster than scientists realized, and that could affect weather systems very far away.
You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The current government in Spain only came together late last year, and it's off to a very shaky start in 2024. Socialist Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez did manage to get two minor laws passed last week. In exchange for their cooperation, one of his coalition partners, a Catalan separatist party, is demanding what appears to be politically impossible. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona.
The first laws Prime Minister Sanchez proposed were hardly controversial, an equality measure for hiring civil servants, an extension of tax breaks for basics, things like food. But Sanchez's Catalan partners want something in return. The Junts party is demanding Catalonia assume total control over immigration, including the right to decide which non-Spaniards can stay and which must go.
Catalunya ha de tenir una política nacional d'immigració, agradi o no agradi a qui vulgui.
Catalonia must have its own national immigration rules, whether others like it or not, said Junts party leader Jordi Turull last week. We need a system that responds to our needs, he said, to our well-being. That was a wink to Junts' unfounded insistence that the more immigrants Spain lets in, the more crime goes up. In a TV interview after New Year's, Turull said that repeat offenders must be dealt with. In other words, career criminals from other countries should be sent packing. Socialist party leaders initially said, sure, we'll give the Catalans power over residency permits, but that concession has blown up in their faces. You can't let one region assume control over national border policy, critics say. It's unconstitutional. And for a leftist coalition, the emphasis on foreign lawbreakers seems awfully conservative, says Ernesto Urtasun. Urtasun is with Sumar, another of the government's coalition partners.
¿Quién ejerce la competencia? Es importante.
Under no circumstances, Urtasun told party leaders this week, should we back xenophobic ideas, especially now when far-right parties are doing so much damage to European democracies. Pedro Sanchez himself would surely agree. His shaky coalition is rife with conflicting interests, but it ultimately stands on one idea, keeping the far right at bay. Appearing to accommodate extremism would be disastrous. So the socialists are now backing away from Junts on migration.
Que en ningún caso debemos abonar cuando hablamos de migración.
Socialist Justice Minister Felix Bolaños cast doubt on Junts' proposal. He told reporters that ultimately European laws prevail. Spain, he said, must be in line with EU rules. And the EU is not likely to condone any individual region whipping up their own national residency rules. That would lead to chaos. But the Junts party has another demand that goes beyond border control. It wants the Catalan people to vote on whether to create their own new borders with Spain and France. In other words, another referendum on independence, even though 7 years ago Spain's highest court deemed such a vote unconstitutional.
I si l'Estat es nega amb rodó, el govern de l'Estat, doncs, com diria aquell, colorín colorado, ja està.
If the central government denies us, Turull said this week, well, colorín colorado. In Spanish fairy tales, that means end of story. In this case, Turull was threatening to walk out on Spain's ruling coalition, effectively ending this government. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
Despite its name, Greenland is synonymous with ice. About 80% of the territory is frozen solid. But scientists say that Greenland's ice sheet is melting at an alarming rate, and that has a wider impact on our oceans. Andrew Shepherd is a professor of geography and environment at Northumbria University in the UK. He helped put together a new report on the rate of ice melt in Greenland.
So Greenland is a little bit further away from the pole than Antarctica, and it's actually quite warm there in summer. And so the changes in air temperature we've seen around the world affect Greenland directly, first of all. So it's been melting at its surface for maybe 20 or 30 years now.
And currently, what rate is the ice melting at, and why is that a point of alarm?
So the pace at which ice is melting from Greenland today is about 6 or 7 times faster than it was in the 1990s. So there's been a rapid rise. In fact, it's really what we would call exponential. If you fit a line through the graph, it's been increasing year on year over the past few decades. And today it's losing about 400 to 500 billion tons of ice per year, which is a good chunk of the sea level rise that we're seeing around the planet.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like a lot. But what are the big concerns when you look at the rising rate of ice melting Greenland?
So there are two main concerns. One is the direct impact it has on sea levels, and that's something that we're concerned about today, but even more so in the future. So every centimetre of sea level rise, we think floods around 2 to 3 million people per year in the, around the planet. And this is something that we can't continue to cope with. But the second thing that happens to ice when it leaves Greenland and enters the oceans is it changes the ocean temperature and the freshness as well. And it also disturbs the currents of water that travel around our planet. And we depend upon those currents for keeping us warmer than we otherwise would be.
Right. Ice melt brings fresh water. Can you explain in layperson's terms why that happens and what kind of impact you anticipate when the seawater composition changes so radically?
Sure. So in the tropics, the oceans are really quite warm and salty. And in the polar regions, they're really cold and fresh. And that helps because it drives circulation of water around our planet between the tropics and the poles. And that for those of us that live far away from the tropics, like in Europe and North America, that brings heat to us from the tropical regions, which are the warmest part of our planet. And if you change the amount of fresh water going into the oceans, that does impact upon this global circulation of heat around the planet. That can cause us to be cooler than we otherwise would be.
Yeah, what you're referring to is the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC, AMOC, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So if less heat is circulating from the tropics, what impact does that have on weather?
Well, it will change most dramatically weather conditions in northwestern Europe. We depend quite heavily upon the supply of heat from the tropics to keep us warmer than similar latitudes in the US. So you might be used to very, very cold winters that last for long time periods in the US, but we're not used to that in Europe. Quite rare that we see the temperatures that you get in northern Canada. And we're not prepared for that. So we'll have to make significant changes to our lifestyles if that heat doesn't arrive.
I mean, it's ironic that melting ice in Greenland could lead to colder winters in Europe.
Yeah, I mean, it's a problem that people can't easily understand because it requires knowledge of the whole Earth system and how we depend upon heat transfer from very, very far away to keep us warmer than we should be. And it doesn't seem like that would be the case, but it is true. The oceans keep us warm.
So, Andrew, assess for us your own kind of level of alarm after kind of knowing what's in this report.
I think people need to be clear that the ice on Earth today is melting much more rapidly than it was in the very recent past. That's a direct consequence of global warming, which is a direct consequence of burning of fossil fuels. So if we want to keep that ice, if we want to keep the habitats that animals within and that we depend upon, we have to change the amount of heating that our planet's going to be subject to.
That's Andrew Shepherd explaining how ice melt affects Earth systems and weather patterns far from the polar regions. Shepherd is a scientist at Northumbria University in the UK and a contributor to new research showing that the ice sheet over Greenland is melting more rapidly than previously understood.
You're listening to The World.
Estonia sits on the border with Russia, a fragile position to be in with a hostile neighbor. That helps explain why folk music is making a comeback there.
Maybe our music makes people think or feel something that they haven't felt for a long time.
Estonia reasserts its ethnic heritage, plus birdwatchers of the world unite. That's still ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. A glimmer of good news from Gaza today. Israel and Hamas have reportedly struck a deal to allow more humanitarian aid into the territory.
As part of the agreement, medicines will reach the Israeli hostages abducted by Hamas. In return, Israel will allow more basic supplies into the Palestinian territory. It is help that's badly needed. British surgeon Graham Groom recently returned from a trip to Gaza, where he says the need for aid was visible, even before he reached the hospital where he was helping victims.
Everywhere we could see masses and masses of people queuing at water points, queuing at anywhere they thought there might be food, huge numbers of improvised shelters, and as I say, a general air of despair.
Two-thirds of Gaza's hospitals are closed. Those still open are barely functioning and incredibly crowded. Dr. Nick Maynard is a surgeon from Oxford, England, who recently led an emergency medical team at the Al-Aqsa Hospital in central Gaza.
every square meter was covered with patients and their relatives, some of them on beds, many of them lying on the floor, in the reception areas, on the stairs, all through the wards.
I spoke with Dr. Maynard earlier today.
The first thing that struck me as we arrived at Al-Aqsa Hospital for the first day was the unbelievable crowding outside the hospital and within the hospital. There was almost like a whole new town had been built up around the hospital with many, many thousands of people migrating to the hospital because they perceived it to be a safe place and had built many makeshift shelters, tents using tarpaulin, canvas, whatever. And then inside the hospital, the crowds were even worse. And to give some perspective on that, the normal capacity of Al-Aqsa Hospital is, I think, about 150, 160 beds. It's a small hospital. And they had about 700 or 800 patients there, but many more thousands of relatives and other people sheltering there. So the crowding was just vast. It really was.
And what about the supplies that you did or didn't have? What was it like performing surgery when I imagine you were missing some critical items?
We always had enough anesthetic agents to put the patients to sleep.
Okay.
But we often had no pain relief to give them. So there was many days when we had no morphine or other strong painkillers. In theatres, we had one day when we had no running water, so we couldn't scrub up properly. We had to just use alcohol gel on our hands. On another day, we had no sterile drapes to cover the patients with, so we had to make our own drapes out of gowns. So very challenging.
Can you share the story of one of the patients that you cared for?
I mean, there were many tragic cases. The one that will really stick in my mind was a six-year-old that I discovered lying on the floor of the emergency department. The process of triage had collapsed completely, and I discovered the six-year-old boy lying on the ground, having been just deposited there. No one had seen him, and he had terrible burns covering his body, had a head injury, and the most life-threatening thing I saw was he had an open chest wound where you could see air being sucked in and out, and that can be a rapidly fatal condition. So myself and one of my colleagues bundled him up and took him into the resuscitation area, which was already packed. There were no beds or trolleys, so we just lay him on the ground and spent about an hour and a half resuscitating him and putting chest drains in, giving him fluids, dressing his burns. And he was certainly better at the end of that, but he obviously had life-threatening injuries. And the tragic to end to the story is that I don't know whether he survived because we weren't able to. It was such chaos in the hospital, despite searching for him the next day. We were not able to find out whether he had survived. And to this day, I don't know whether he's alive or not.
Wow. That must be very hard as a doctor to not know what happened to your patient.
Yeah, very tough.
What about the conditions that you were working in? Was this a frightening place to be operating?
I don't want to say we got used to it, because that sort of, in a way, diminishes it. I don't really mean that. We were listening to explosions all the time we were there. We didn't get any decent night's sleep for a whole 2 weeks because of the recurrent bombings and the machine gun fire we heard all the time. But we managed to get on with the job. And indeed, when there was an attack on the hospital a couple of weeks ago, we were rapidly withdrawn.
And so your mission was cut short because there was increasing Israeli military activity at the hospital where you were working?
Yes. On Friday, I think it was the 5th of January, I was operating all day on a very severely injured young lady with blast injuries to her abdomen and chest. And came out of the operating theatre about 3 o'clock to hear that there had been a single missile attack on the intensive care unit. So we left that day, and each evening the process we had to go through, our team had to go through, was to essentially get permission from the liaison part of the Israeli Defence Force to go to the hospital to get their agreement that it would be deconflicted for us to travel there and work in the hospital. And we were told that night that the area was no longer deconflicted, that there would be military activity, and therefore it would not be safe for us to go.
I understand that all the doctors from abroad at the Al-Aqsa Hospital had to leave. The head of the World Health Organization has called that hospital the most important one remaining in central Gaza. Who is remaining to treat patients there?
Virtually no one. It is clearly not able to function as a proper hospital anymore.
Dr. Maynard, you probably saw some of the video released by the Israeli military showing hostages being brought into the main hospital in Gaza City back on October 7th. Did you ever see Palestinian militants inside the hospital where you were working?
No, I didn't. And I spent 2 weeks in the hospital, in every single part of the hospital, all day. We were based in the operating theatres, but we went to all the wards, all the different departments, and I never saw any evidence of any Hamas militants in the hospital.
So the Israeli military says that Hamas does operate in hospitals and has tunnels running under them, but you're saying you personally didn't see any evidence of that?
I personally saw no evidence whatsoever. I've worked in Gaza for many years. I've worked in Shifa Hospital prior to this conflict on many occasions, and I've never, in all my years going to Gaza and operating in the hospitals, I've never seen any evidence of Hamas militants in the hospitals. The one caveat being, I, of course, have no idea what's going on in tunnels underneath. But in the hospitals, I've never seen any evidence of that.
Al-Shifa Hospital is where pictures supplied by Israel suggest that there were entrances to Hamas tunnels in the hospital. But you didn't see any of that?
No, I didn't. I was last in Shifa Hospital in May of this year, carrying out major surgery with my colleagues there. And I know Shifa Hospital well. I've walked all round the hospital over the years. I don't know what's going on underneath it, but I certainly saw no evidence of any Hamas militants in the hospital. And I did go throughout all different departments in the hospital.
Mm, okay. Can I ask how you're holding up after going through such a challenging experience?
Thank you for asking that. The small group that were together, we've talked a lot. We've met up since we got back. We had shared experience. We've talked about our experiences. I've got a hugely supportive family, but it's taking time to process a lot of it. And I think we're just sort of working our way through it. But the override, you know, we've had many, many mixed emotions since we left Gaza. A lot of distress, a lot of, you know, flashbacks to what we saw. We've all felt guilt as well for leaving, which mm-hmm. might be irrational, but I think we've all felt the guilt. And most importantly, a desperation to get back out there as soon as we can. And we will do, and I'll be going back in early March, I hope.
Mm. So you do plan to go back?
Most certainly, yes.
Dr. Nick Maynard recently returned from Gaza, where he led an emergency medical team in the Al-Aqsa Hospital in central Gaza. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for listening to me.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
Japan Airlines has named its first woman president. Mitsuko Totori began with the company as a flight attendant in 1985. Her appointment comes 2 weeks after a fiery and fatal collision of two planes at a Tokyo airport. In a news conference today, Totori promised to make safety a priority.
Renowned Mexican writer Jose Agustin has died at 79. He chronicled rock and roll and social change in Mexico in the 1960s and 70s as part of a cultural movement there known as La Onda, or the Wave. For many Mexican youth, it was the first time they found their struggles reflected in formal literature.
And chicken wings, that quintessential bar food, gets a special local treatment wherever they show up on the menu. For years in China, New Orleans-style chicken wings have been a mainstay. The Wall Street Journal reports, however, that the dish appears to have zero culinary connections to the Big Easy.
And that's a few things you might have missed.
Folk music in the small Baltic nation of Estonia is hot right now. Young musicians are rediscovering traditional songs and instruments. A lot of this has to do with reasserting Estonia's unique national identity. Reporter Sanya Narang caught up with a quartet of women in the capital, Tallinn.
While walking around an industrial warehouse district called Teliskivi, I wander into a music venue where there's a small stage for what they call folktronica music this evening. I'm suddenly transported from an area that was formerly a locomotive factory to a trendy musical hub. The harmonies of four Estonian women musicians on stage brings the crowd to an instant hush. The group is called Uhunessa, which means humidity in Estonian. They sing old folk hymns in traditional Baltic Finnish styles, known as runo. The vocalists are accompanied by a keyboard and the tagelharpa. That's a horsehair harp, which is also played in Sweden. The day after the concert, I sit down with them to ask how they formed this band.
There was an event in Estonia that brought together all the folk music students from different music universities.
That's Kaisa Kuslapu, their keyboardist and organ player.
I met these two amazing singers, and I immediately fell in love with their voices, and I thought, like, I need to combine these and find a way to do something with them.
Vocalist Marion Seligal says what brought them together was the material.
It was the Estonian old folk chorals or folk hymns, because we all find them really fascinating because just the melodies are so beautiful and ornamented.
After 5 decades of Soviet occupation, from 1940 to 1991, Estonians became intensely proud of their heritage to show that they're separate and independent. This led to a revival of music that is deeply rooted in Estonia, much of it going back generations. Greta-Liisa Grunberg sings and plays the horsehair harp.
It was just a yearning for connecting with my culture, with my past, with our culture, just connecting with my roots. And I've always searched for something with a deeper meaning, so I felt folk music is the way to go.
Their music blends voices into a harmony as they sing folk verses accompanied by traditional instruments.
Music has been a tool for being able to, like, just forget all the hard field work and managing a farm, you know, and in the olden days it was crucial to have this thing to balance.
The resurgence of folk music began in the late 1980s, a few years before Estonia gained independence. In recent years, it's become popular among a younger generation who are bringing in newer sounds. Oliver Berg works for a foundation in the southern Estonian city of Tartu. It's been selected as a European Capital of Culture for 2024.
But Estonians really aren't big on institutionalized religion, but we're pagans by heart, you know. And it's this connection to these old pagan roots and, like, this symbiosis with nature that really you feel is channeled in this folk music scene, and where you feel that we have this urging for these ancient roots.
He says that under Soviet rule, Estonians used music as an act of rebellion. For example, Estonians revived their forbidden national anthem in front of Soviet authorities as a form of protest.
We are a singing nation. You know, some of the songs had a very strong, you know, patriotic background to them that kept, like, this, I'd say, the spark of a collective identity alive. Yeah, what we refer to as the singing revolution. The singing revolution that we managed to sing ourselves free. Well, of course, it was, you know, global political system that, you know, made the window of opportunity happen.
In their music, the women of Uhunessa weave in the uniquely Estonian tradition of regalau. It's a poetic rhythm based on the continuous repetition of 8-syllable verses.
It's hard to say how old it is, but it's more or less 2,000 years old. So it has really some old mythical elements in it. The melody is usually quite simple, so it's something really nice also to just go into and let it carry you away.
Towards the end of the interview, I ask the ladies to sing something a cappella. And they astound me with this. Though I can't understand the words, it has a meditative effect and makes me cry.
I always sometimes start to cry in the rehearsal when they're singing. I'm just like, oh my God, it's so beautiful. It's very beautiful, this song. I feel like this is also my favorite. Maybe our music makes people think or feel something that they haven't felt for a long time, like something, a connection with something very beautiful.
It's a soothing yet powerful way to bring these melodies back to life and preserve Estonian culture. For the world, I'm Sonia Narang, Tallinn, Estonia. Mulla annadi
Higher education in the U.S., it is wildly expensive, an outlier when you look at costs elsewhere in the world. And yet many international students are drawn to study in the U.S. because of the opportunities it can provide.
If you are an international student, how do you foot the bill for tuition in America? We want to hear how you're paying for school and what makes the financial hurdle worthwhile for you.
This is a call out to international students studying in the U.S. Send us a voice memo about your experience. Email myworld@theworld.org. Again, that's myworld@theworld.org. And thanks very much. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. If you don't have a bird watcher in the family like I do, let me tell you, birding is a huge hobby around the world. It's a multi-million dollar industry and a big draw for ecotourism. But most professional bird guides, the people who earn most of those tourism dollars, are men.
In Uganda, women are working to change that. The country now has the biggest club for professional women bird guides anywhere.
Oh, yeah. Beautiful.
From Uganda, Anita Elash reports.
It's a Sunday morning in Entebbe's historic botanical gardens, where you can find more than 400 bird species. A group of young women has just spotted one of them, the spectacular broad-billed roller.
Oh, very beautiful bird.
Very beautiful bird. Look at my light on the ground, but let's go on that branch. Okay.
Most of these women are training to be professional bird guides. Priscilla Kabarungi started last year. She's already learned to identify more than 200 species.
Oh, I love birds. And when birds are everywhere, you can miss a lion, but you can't miss a bird.
Her favorite is the elusive and increasingly rare Papyrus gonalec. She's already a safari guide, but she really loves turning people on to the beauty of birds.
Even when someone is not all that interested in a bird, but by the time you finish talking to this person will have got that love for birds. Because of the colors, the calls.
For Macklin Komagen, birds bring back memories of childhood in rural Uganda. Her mother taught her that birds call to communicate things, like danger or the start of the dry season.
She's illiterate. She did not study. But using her local knowledge, her indigenous knowledge, she uses birds as a means of communication.
Macklin adores parrots because of the way they mimic people. She discovered bird watching while studying hospitality at university and immediately decided to make a career of it.
I just want to be the best bird guide. I just want to find I can identify every bird I come across.
Macklin already works for a travel agency, but as a booking agent, she earns a fraction of what bird guides get paid. Until recently, she struggled to find the money for training and basic equipment like binoculars and guidebooks. And with a two-year-old at home, it's been a challenge to find the time to develop her skills.
Here in Uganda, it's mostly women who take care of the house. A man can wake up and move for birding without looking at the children. But you're a woman. If you ever wake up and just leave kids without having breakfast, we leave kids without making sure they are all okay, you have committed a crime.
Ironically, it was a man who founded the Uganda Women Bird Guides in 2013.
The tourism business had been dominated by men for a very long time.
Herbert Byarahunga is one of Uganda's most distinguished guides. He's known for taking apprentices under his wing, but he never thought of including women until a birdwatching trip in Illinois led by a female guide.
She was 65 years old, and she was able to whistle out birds. And I was like, wow, if she can do this at 65, what about our girls in Uganda?
Women don't whistle in Uganda. It's one of the cultural taboos that's kept them out of the industry. The club targets those taboos by giving women the experience and resources they need to prove they can do the job. At this point, there are more than 100 members and 30 women earning a living as bird guides. Anthropologist Wendy Ha says the club has had a global impact.
What's surprising is how few women guides there are in countries where you wouldn't think this would be an issue.
Ha is based in upstate New York. She's writing a book about the working lives of women bird guides around the world. She says even in countries like the United States, women bird guides have battled against stereotypes.
You know, how capable are you really of doing this? Do you really know your stuff? Can you actually drive this vehicle?
She says Uganda's women guides are known around the world. Some countries have started their own clubs, and more travel agencies are training women or asking specifically for women guides.
Are we hearing the call?
At the Entebbe Botanical Garden, the bird guides have just spotted an African grey parrot.
It's just flewing in that big, this big tree.
Priscilla Kabarungi says these kinds of experiences have given her the network and the courage to challenge stereotypes. She's learned how to drive a safari vehicle and apprenticed as a mechanic.
And all those are male-dominated skills. So you have to first put the woman in your side and try to be a man somewhere in those skills.
Macklin Komagen says the club uncovered a dream she never knew she had. She still can't afford binoculars, but she knows that one day she will.
My dream is not yet fulfilled fully as I want, but now I'm in the line. At least I'm in the line of fulfilling it. And I will make it. I'm trusting myself that I will make it.
For the world, I'm Anita Elash, Entebbe, Uganda.
Here's something about Colombia that you might not have known. It has more varieties of orchids than any country on Earth. More than 1,500 types of orchids, all unique to the country. This is something Colombian-American singer-songwriter Cali Uchis raises up on her second all-Spanish language album. It's called Orquídeas.
This single is a bolero titled Te Mata, or It Kills You. It's been a huge hit across the Latin music world since Uchis released Orquídeas last October. The album runs the gamut from lo-fi to hip-hop, and this song of unrequited love and heartache stands out for its bangly throwback sound. Uchis also releases albums in English, and she told Billboard News recently that she didn't have a specific strategy in releasing this second all-Spanish album.
I grew up very much like Spanglish, bilingual, you know, I went to school in Colombia, I finished my education in the United States, so I had that experience of really living in both countries and having a childhood in both countries, and I learned to read and write Spanish before English.
If you feel like staying up late tonight, Cali Uchis is slated to perform on Jimmy Kimmel Live. That is our show for this Wednesday. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting from the Nan and Bill Harris studio.
And from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. We're online at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Thanks for listening. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll see you right back here again tomorrow.